Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, you look a little tired today. Is everything all right?
Yeah, I was just up late watching Ken Burns' country music special.
Oh, I heard that was fantastic. Did you get into any cool music? Jim? Jim, I need you here to do the podcast. He's gonna snore.
Okay, we've been meaning to get to this for a while.
Yes, we have.
We started something not too long ago. It's At the Movies, where we talk about movies that I've watched recently.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to talk about this Ken Burns country music documentary series. It's a film, so it counts as movies. Yeah.
Totally.
And it
was long.
Yeah, it was 8 parts, 2 hours each, so that, by my math, 16 hours. And I just consumed it, like, right away.
Yeah.
Every night was watching 2 hours. I think there were a couple of double headers there.
Mm-hmm.
Double features,
as
you call them. But what was surprising... Well, hang on. I'll get to that in a moment. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And we have a special guest here.
Yes, we do. We're at maximum capacity.
That's
in the basement.
Right. Welcome, Nick Scalera.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You've heard Nick before.
He's been here for... 2 weeks,
yeah,
actually.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
He slept on my floor twice during Flying Nun week, which is a big week. I mean, people were camped out. It was great. Yeah.
It is. That's when we have our big pledge drive.
That's right. We're going to do it next year. We're just going to have camping.
We save that.
Everything's $20. You get a propane.
Tote bags.
Yeah. So,
or a propane tank, whichever you want.
So this Ken Burns country music thing comes on the PBS, and... you know, I had to watch it because I like Ken Burns' work a lot. And when he's doing something on music, I'm like, this will be really fascinating.
Yep.
And what I knew I was going to like it, and I did. But what really surprised me is how much my wife really liked it.
That's great.
And she is not a country music fan really at all.
Sweet.
To the point where she's kind of, she's very dismissive of it, even, you know, sort of like the whole idea that even she. I think she's worried that if she, you know, like listens to country music, people might think differently of her or something, right? You know,
or she might like it.
Yeah, she would lose her, you know, her punker girl cred, right?
Right.
So, we watch it, and that was her reaction. She was like, "Well, I guess I gotta like country music now." You know, she was just fascinated by it as well. But the key to it, I think, for anyone who maybe grew up in a later era of country music is what you really realize is how different it was and sort of how pure and authentic it was. And you, and how much you can really connect, I think, with a lot of that music from an earlier era. And also, how incredibly talented these people were, both as players and as songwriters. Mm-hmm. And this was an era for the most part where they wrote their own songs. Not entirely, but to a large extent. I mean, certainly guys like Hank Williams and stuff like that, you know,
sure,
some of the greatest American songwriters. And also that you just get a, you know, it predates rock and roll. So you're getting a sense of where the music you like came from too.
Yeah.
I mean, and then it gets into that when it gets into the '50s, it talks about Sun Studios and, you know, the rockabilly and all that kind of stuff being sort of an offshoot of country music. Right. So, I thought it was really fascinating. And we asked some listeners for their impressions, and we got a call and we got an email. We'll get to that in a second here.
Sweet.
But let me turn to Nick here and just get, you know, some quick impressions from Nick, who actually works for a PBS affiliate.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can come back and have a more substantive discussion on this.
Cool. Yeah, I work for WETA, which was the DC area public PBS station. And WETA also is a producing station for all Ken Burns documentaries. It's a little bit of inside baseball. I won't bore you with it. But
what does that mean, though, Nick? I mean, when you're the producing station.
Yep.
He just said he wasn't going to
bore
us with
it. I wasn't going to bore you with it, but
I couldn't resist.
But,
all right.
Yeah, it's basically, the stations actually work with filmmakers to present content to the PBS system.
Oh, okay.
And so WETA happens to have a partnership with Ken Burns that goes back 30 years. And we work with him to help promote, help raise money, and you know, get the productions made. And as you can imagine, Ken Burns has, you know, leeway to do what he wants when he wants to do it. And PBS offers a venue for him to do these long piece narratives that just wouldn't exist anywhere else.
Got it.
Let's get to a phone call here.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Patrick. Jesse Jackson here from Dallas, Texas, and set listing Bruce. I loved Ken Burns' country music. I've been a fan of all his documentaries, especially baseball and jazz, but this one I think by far is his best. The idea that all of country music was started really in a small little town, Bristol, Tennessee, with Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family is just amazing. And each episode, you continue to see how it all builds upon itself. And I think they did a brilliant job of showing how the music expanded and changed, yet also stayed true to itself. And the pendulum of, you know, the Nashville sound to the classic country back and forth. It is truly an amazing 16 hours, but I hope your audience loved it. And I've said, even if you're not a fan of country music, this documentary is fascinating and great to watch and listen to. So thank you guys. I can't wait to hear what everyone else thinks about it. Once again, this is Jesse Jackson from Dallas, Texas.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jesse.
Oh, it's good to hear from Jesse.
So I think if anyone has seen a Ken Burns documentary, you'll understand the format here. He has a formula. It works well for him, and he can make it work because he has this incredible access, and his team does incredible research to get, you know, footage and get the right interviews and the right people. But, you know, you have sort of talking head sort of format where people sort of tell the story. And this one did not rely so much on historians as other of his topics, you know, Vietnam War and certainly Civil War, where you don't have, you know, firsthand, you know, people to tell the story.
Did he make one on the Civil War?
He did. there was, I think, one historian who was in it throughout, but for the most part, it was other musicians talking about these people. The one guy who was like a big revelation who comes off as a historian because he just seems to have an encyclopedic knowledge about everyone and everything was Marty Stewart.
Yeah.
And I've read this other places too that like people are sort of like, who's this guy Marty Stewart? Now people are diving into his work.
Yeah.
But he's a guy came up through bluegrass, came out of Mississippi and was playing bluegrass and he ended up, you know, playing with like Flatten Scruggs and stuff like that.
Yeah. He cut his teeth in the right places.
Yeah. Played with everybody and then went off and did some more, you know, more quote-unquote country records and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, he just really knows his stuff, and it's really fascinating, you know, when you have somebody like that who can tell these stories of all these people. Vince Gill came off very well, I think, in that regard, too. Roseanne Cash seemed to know sort of everything as well. So just fascinating people. So you have the sort of talking head kind of thing, and then you have the narration by Peter Coyote, which he's used for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, footage, lots of photographs, lots of ways that he sort of manipulates the photographs to make them interesting. And then, you know, in this case, you have some live footage, but it's not really, I wouldn't say there's tons of music in it. I mean, you get little clips certainly when it's important, but it's not like you're watching, you know,
what they call it are music cues. And, you know, so I have some, you know, I promised Jim some inside info on the production. So I pulled some fact sheets. There were 584 music cues. Right.
But okay.
So there's a lot of editing and putting in little snippets of music. But Jim's right. There's not a long, you know, a long play on a single song.
Yeah.
You don't hear anything 2 or 3 minutes full in this or see a full performance or anything like
that. That's right. I would be a terrible editor on something like this because I will tell you, even ending the podcast, I'm always like, I want to let this run a little bit longer. You know, it's really hard. But yeah, you just get enough of Hey Good Looking to, you know,
right,
so you remember the song and like, okay, that was Hank Williams, right?
And it's true. It's a good point about the interviews because actually they didn't start, as I understand it, Ken did not necessarily want to start with no historians. They interviewed a lot of historians and then they interviewed a lot of musicians. And what they found out were that the musicians were such big fans and essentially historians themselves that the stories they told were more compelling. That when it's not like Ken didn't go to the experts, because they always go to the experts. But in terms of the way this one comes off, and Jazz had a lot, his series on Jazz had a lot more sort of journalists and historians on Jazz, but this one really leans on the artists themselves.
And it's interesting, I think, because of that, what is a more oral American tradition than country music, right? It was always in these little hollers in these little towns. And there was, you know, the Carter family famously drove from Clinch Mountain to Bristol in like 48 hours, right? And it was like 10 miles or whatever. But because of that, and I think it's important that, and I have not seen the whole series, but I think it's important that he did it in that way. I think it's important that the people who play the music are also the ones that learned when they were young and are now passing it on to the next generation. Right. So I think that was brilliantly smart.
And you referenced this a little bit. I got to say, I got scared every time they went on the road.
Yeah.
If you watch this, there's a couple of scenes where someone gets on a plane or gets on a drive. Yeah. And if you don't know the history, like, you know, frankly, I didn't. I was telling Jim earlier, my country music fandom is kind of starts with Johnny Cash and ends with Johnny Cash. Maybe Wilco, a little, Americana with alt country. So I didn't know a lot of the stories of how some of these artists, where they came up, how they died, what their lives were like. So you get a lot of that too. You get a lot of sort of like the, where they came from, who influenced them, and the connecting tissues between the different strands of music is fascinating. And in the end, it's really American history. Music is a big piece of this, but that's why I think people like your wife and other folks who don't like country, if you care about America, you care about American history, you get all of the main themes of the last, 60, 70 years through this.
And in a very simple way, what it teaches you, what country music teaches you, and they lay this out really early, is, that sort of the different cultural influences that could only come together in America, right? So a most basic example is this. If country music early on was sort of the marriage of the fiddle and the banjo coming together, right? Mm-hmm. So the fiddle being a European instrument, the violin, essentially, right? But violin and classical, but then the fiddle in like English and Irish folk music, Celtic music, all that. That coming from Europe, and then the banjo is an African instrument, right? But it's the marriage of those two things could really only happen here and created this sound that you associate with this form of music, right?
Yeah, and I think to add one thing to that would be the English folk tradition of all these songs that came lyrically, and that's like A.P. Carter basically just took these old English folk ballads, figured out he could copyright them himself, and invented the canon of country music.
That's right.
With an amazing female guitar player and, another member of the family.
But there's also blues and gospel influence as well.
Totally.
That goes into it.
I was standing by the window on one cold and cloudy day, and I saw the hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away. Oh, can the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a bitter home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky.
It really is like jazz, the true American music. And it's interesting to me. I don't know. I grew up, Nick was saying, like, Johnny Cash, I mean, that for me was like before I was 12, I had every Johnny Cash album because that was just what we listened to in my family. And they were people from West Virginia. And so I got a really solid grounding in country music because of that really early on. But I still found it very refreshing. And like you were saying, Nick, he breathes life. He makes the characters 3D instead of flat historical figures. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was impressed with. My VCR is being repaired. I have all
VCR.
One got stuck. I think I was recording each episode on VCR, VHS, not beta.
Not beta. Okay. Yep.
And so I'm just, that's one.
There is a more modern way to watch it, Patrick, okay. If you're interested. I want to get this in. Just for those of you, it's a lot. It's 16 hours. It is going to re-air on PBS stations. I don't have the date yet, but it's going to be early in 2020.
Okay.
But also, For those of you who are members of your local PBS station at the rate of $5 a month, mm-hmm. You get access to PBS Passport, and that is, you know, a way for you to stream all the episodes on Roku, on Apple TV. And in fact, that's the way I've been watching all of them. I have them all on my Passport membership, and I am 11 hours through, so I got five more, and you know, I really want to finish it. Very motivated.
Can you get Downton Abbey on that as well?
You can as well.
Well, I want to say that this series prompted me to donate and get the PBS Passport.
That's awesome, man.
So I have done that. Although for a while, you could watch it on the PBS app without Correct. Passport, which is what I did. But then mm-hmm. I was like, you know, I need to support this the right way. So yeah. I joined and got the Passport thing. But now I'm very excited because you get all the Austin City Limits.
Oh, like, nice. Mm-hmm,
like 40 plus seasons of Austin City Limits you can stream. And there's also a show called Soundbreaking. Have you seen this?
Yes, I have. That's a great series.
That I've really wanted to
came
watch.
Out a couple years ago.
Yeah, a couple years ago. It's a documentary series about actually like recording music.
Hmm.
Like what goes into recording music. Yeah. So I'm excited about that. So just a little, you know, plug here for PBS Passport. I think there's some good music content on there.
Well, and I'll tell you from my experience, I think it was episode 9, there was a windstorm. So I was up there trying to get the antenna stabilized so I could keep my VCR going. Not paying PBS for free. No, I'm just kidding.
So we do broadcast for free over the air for those of you like Patrick.
I was about to say.
Like to do it the old-fashioned way.
We still live in a democracy.
So speaking of media, this is one thing I wanted to say about the origins of country music. And when you watch the first episode in particular, you see how important it was not only that the invention of recorded music, which, you know, really became something in the 1920s. And this is when the series starts. You know, we all know of the Grand Ole Opry, Grand Ole Opry. It's been around forever and everybody's heard that term or whatever. But what we don't realize is it was like MTV, you know, at that time. Right.
Absolutely.
It was the radio program that you had to listen to, you know, every week. And it had, and because Nashville was like sort of right in the middle of the country there, and they had that clear channel signal and they could
50,000 watts.
Yeah.
Right? And
They could hit just enormous amounts of North America.
Yeah. They could hit Hibbing, Minnesota, for example.
That's right.
Yeah, indeed.
That just became, that was a huge driver in the popularity of the music. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
The one other thing I want to say too about the really early stuff is that kind of surprised me. I think for us, you know, we grew up in an era where you think of country music as, you know, traditional, old timey, sort of looking backward. That's not for, you know, the wild youth of today, right? Why would we be interested in that? Well, the funny thing is, in the 1920s, when it was becoming popularized, a big reason why it became so popular was that was the first time that as many people lived in cities as lived in rural areas. Right. That was where the turning point was really happening. Right. And so for a lot of people who lived in cities, that was like nostalgia music for them. It reminded them of the country, right?
Right, where they came from.
Right, and so that became sort of comfort music in a way. And so they would buy these records, you know? And so it's funny to me that country music from the very beginning was essentially kind of looking backward, right?
Interesting.
Right.
Yeah, really interesting.
One of the things that actually fascinated me is that you have the traditional, but you also had like technology plays a role here, right? You have the pedal steel guitar that comes in, and that becomes a signature piece of technology that came from Hawaii, right? Yeah. I mean, you think of Hawaii music, that becomes, you know, there are some folks who say it ain't country if there's no, you know, pedal steel in it.
Oh,
you
totally.
Know? I mean, that's the extent. And but that was a thing that happened, you know, that came in with sort of the cowboy with Gene Autry and those Beam cowboy movies in the 40s. It wasn't a thing that existed before. So there is traditionalism, but there's also the use of new technology. Electric guitar comes in, you know, big time into the Fender Telecaster was sort of like, you know, became a signature guitar that is a big part of rock music as well. So there's that too. And as Jim referenced, the radio stations and the power of radio, and that station WSM, which was actually run by an insurance company. I don't know if you remember that bit. And their real intent with Grand Ole Opry was to sell insurance,
which
I think is another fascinating bit of like, that's America for you. You've got culture, you got business. Those things got to happen.
Right. And they were actually predated by a show in out of Chicago called the Barn Dance or something like that. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like, sort of like funny to think that like the beginning, like the first big popular country music radio show was in Chicago.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Yeah.
There were many regional scenes that were very popular. Oh, yeah. Shreveport was very important. Yep. Louisiana Hayride.
Yep, that one.
You know, helped launch Elvis's career as well.
And then you had the Carter family went down to Mexico and broadcast from
border
there.
Border radio.
Border radio, yeah. Very interesting. Okay, I want to read an email we got here from Mike Snyder,
right?
Our friend Mike. He says, Ken Burns' country music series brought back a lot of memories for me. I grew up in a home where country and Western played constantly, from Eddie Arnold, Conway Twitty, and Tammy Wynette, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, Dolly Parton, and Porter Wagoner, Charlie Pride, and Charlie Rich. My parents dragged me to scores of country concerts, usually benefits for the Topeka Fire Department, that were miniature Grand Ole Opry shows with multiple acts, including Farron Young, Little Jimmy Dickens, Dolly and Porter, Johnny Cash and June Carter, Buck Owens, and many others. We also regularly watched Hee Haw. At the time, I didn't appreciate all that exposure to country music, but over the years, I learned to. Thankfully, those experiences prepared me to keep an ear open for country music when my ears would be more accepting. When Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and others began embracing their own non-Nashville sound music, that really spoke to me. It also led me back to Merle Haggard, who also led me to Bob Wills and Jimmy Rogers. All of this is music I still listen to today and informs my authenticity meter for music in general. I loved how Burns and Company unfurled the roots of country and how the music's evolution entwined with blues, folk, bluegrass, and rock. The stories of Willie Nelson's Redheaded Stranger becoming a success, Dolly leaving Porter Wagoner's TV show, and Vince Gill's sadness at the death of George Jones touched my heart in different ways. And it was great to see the clips of footage of Bob Dylan recording with Johnny Cash and Dylan's appearance on Cash's TV show. The interviews with the extended Cash family tree of Roseanne Cash, John Carter Cash, Marty Stewart, and Rondi Crowell added to the series heft. And that's just a hint of what the series offers. He could write copy for you guys, right?
I know. Okay. Should we get on the payroll?
All right. Mike says...
Is he a writer?
Yeah. Mike says, I'll close with a personal memory that the series reminded me of. In 1994, I did a long trip with Professor Doug Brinkley and his Magic Bus class, which annually took college students on road trip across the U.S. studying history, culture, government, art, literature, and music, and meeting people like Maya Angelou, Robert Hunter, recently passed RIP, Allen Ginsberg, George McGovern, Kurt Vonnegut, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and Hunter S. Thompson. In California, we caught up with Waylon Jennings after one of his concerts, and he met the 18 students and the rest of the entourage, myself included. I got to sneak in a question when saying goodbye and ask if there was any current musician who impressed him. His answer surprised me when he said, Trent Reznor. Hmm. Of course, I asked why, and he said, his melodies are strong, but he could clean up his language. I remembered that incident again while watching Country Music and its detailing of Johnny Cash's career resurgence with the series of albums produced by Rick Rubin, including 2002's American Four, The Man Comes Around, which included a version of Nine Inch Nails' Hurt. I would have never put those two artists together, but Waylon, who died in 2002, a year before Cash did, had already foreshadowed it. Mike Snyder.
Wow. Beautiful stuff, Mike.
Yeah.
Thank you, man.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt. I will let you down.
That's great. And I appreciate that Mike went through a lot of the names of the people who were in the series, so we don't have to cover all of that. Right. I will say, though, that there is like there is a theme that recurs a lot when you get to these people's stories, really throughout the decades, with a few exceptions here or there, to the point where it's not Ken Burns' fault. This is history. But the point where you could sort of parody this a little bit, it was tended to be like he grew up in a family, the youngest of 13 children, on a dirt floor, you know. His parents discovered he was talented at music at a young age. He used it as a way to escape the, you know, the poverty conditions.
Bought him
all
a $10 guitar at Sears.
That's right. Yeah, things like that. Pretty much you heard that story about a dozen times. Yeah. But then you'd get to somebody like Kris Kristofferson, and you'd be like, what
the hell?
Because he came from a privileged family.
That's right.
And then purposely, like, worked as a janitor in a recording studio in Nashville so he could try to get his break. And it took him like 2 or 3 years of doing
that's
that,
right?
So
threw away a lot of bad lyrics before he actually got some good ones.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. Didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled through my closet for my clothes and found my cleanest dirty shirt. And I shaved my face and combed my hair and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day. I'd smoked my brain the night before on cigarettes and songs that I'd been picking. But I lit my first and watched a small kid cussing at a can that he was kicking. Then I crossed the empty street, caught the Sunday smell of someone frying chicken. And it took me back to something that I'd lost somehow, somewhere along the way. On the Sunday morning sidewalk, wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. There's something in a Sunday makes a body.
Was there anyone you discovered, Nick, during the music, you know, that turned you on that you didn't know about or thought was kind of cool?
I mean, Jimmy Rogers, I think, really stands out for me in the beginning. You know, that just the authenticity of the music, and also the fact that, you know, again, another terrible story. He has TB. You write a song about TB blues. Right. I'm like, you know, it takes a lot of courage to sort of like speak about the thing that's basically killing you.
My good gal's trying to make a fool out of me. Lord, my gal trying to make a fool out of me. Trying to make me believe I ain't got that old TB. I've got the TB blue. When it rained down sorrow, it rained all over me. When it rained down sorrow, it rained all over me. Cause my body rattles like a train on that old SP. I've got the TB blue. I've got that old TB, I can't eat a bite. Got that old TB, I can't eat a bite.
DeFord Bailey too with that song Fox Chase, which is just fascinating. You know, it's sort of, I guess it would, when it was played, dogs would bark because of those sounds. You know, and just the early stuff really did stick out for me. I also have to say that I had a very surfacey knowledge of Hank Williams, and people would ask me, you know, I'd be like, well, Hank Williams is real country music. And I'd say this in a sort of like, because in like an indie cred way, but I don't know what I was talking about. It was just a BS kind of thing I would do with folks, because I have some family that are into new country, the kind of very popular stuff. And I'd be like, you got to listen to Hank Williams. Yeah. Well, I hadn't really listened to Hank Williams in any major way. But, you know, he's a fascinating character. I mean, his talent as a songwriter, the fact that he could just like just knock one off in 5 minutes, that would just be a huge hit.
Hell yeah.
It's amazing. And, you know, also I didn't, you know, his life story is another tragic story. And I just remember thinking he died at 29, and you look at him and you look 65, you know, I mean,
yeah, man.
But he lived in pain his whole life with, you know, and he had a bad back, and spina bifida. And, you know, it's amazing how productive some of these folks were in a very short period of time under some pretty terrible circumstances.
Yeah.
I mean, Hank Williams was essentially a rock star before such a thing existed.
Totally, man.
You know, it was unfortunate, but it was that live fast, die young sort of lifestyle and, you know, heavy drinker and just always on the go, just constantly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can kind of give him, I mean, did he invent rock and roll? I mean, moving on over is a rock and roll song, right? And I heard that and I'm like, we've all heard this before, but I'm like, wait a minute, that was a Hank Williams song.
Came in last night at 10:30. That baby of mine wouldn't let me in. So move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, little dog, cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more. So get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog, cause the fat dog's moving in. This dog house here is mighty small, but it's better than no house at all. So ease it on over.
Move it on over.
Drag it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, old dog, cause a new dog's moving in.
I remember, I think George Thorogood did that song.
Oh, yeah, he did.
That was my sort of reference point for it. And I was like, you know, and that was like 1947. You almost got this sense that Hank Williams could have invented rock and roll, but he had other things going on. So he just kind of left that, because that song is actually a bit of an outlier. It's not a lot like his other songs, but wow, it's fantastic.
Yeah, totally. But I think the other thing that you and I were talking about is how broad of a brush do you have to use to paint something as big as country music, right? Because you can go way down the rabbit hole, and maybe that's Ken Burns' genius, is that he knows exactly the right size brush to kind of use. Look at that book.
I forgot to mention, I have the Ken Burns
companion book.
Companion book.
Written by Dayton Duncan, who should get some cred too here. He writes, he's written a lot of Ken Burns' documentary. When you think about it, I mean, they do get written, right? And Ken is the director.
Yes.
And
they are scripted.
You know, that then, you know, Peter Coyote's fabulous voice is reading some of this text, but you can get it all in this book too.
And that's really cool. I mean, when you do something like this, obviously you have to compile a visual companion and you have to learn about the sheet music and the photographs and you have to immerse yourself in it to tell the story. So why not document that you collected all that material?
And it's a good point, because they actually did. It's beautiful. I mean, they conducted just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of interviews, and not a lot of it ends even in 16 hours. A lot was in the cutting room floor. But for folks who don't know, they did donate all of the interview footage to the Country Music Hall of Fame. So fantastic. Sort of like it was also a reclamation and kind of archival project as well. You know?
That's important.
I just want to say one thing about songwriting. You know, the thing about country music, it has a rich tradition of story songs and direct lyrics. Yep. You don't have to figure out what they're singing about, right? It's right there in front of you. And I think for us being rock fans, you know, take a band like REM, for example, right? You like decades later, you still don't know what the hell they're talking about half the time. And you can have a long conversation with your friends about that. Right. Like, what was he saying in Harbor Coat, right? Or whatever, right? And I think we tend to think like that's better songwriting in some way, that it's that, you know, you have to sort of like figure it out or interpret it on your own or have your own idea of what it is. But is it really? I mean, my point is a song with direct lyrics that can just hit you and you get it, but man, it just like pierces you right from the first time you listen to it. If it's done well, that could be a really great song.
I know,
right?
It goes back to the ancient tomb of like, sorry, this letter is so long, I didn't have time to write a shorter one.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I mean, some people consider He Stopped Loving Her Today to be the greatest country song of all time. And
or the Grand Tour, like, wow. Yeah.
And those are just great songs. Doesn't matter the genre. I mean, you hear that song. Yeah. There was a point in the documentary where there was a woman who worked at the studio where Waylon Jennings recorded, and she said the first time she heard He Stopped Loving Her Today on the radio driving, she had to pull over because she was going to cry,
right.
You know?
Right.
I went to see him just today. Oh, but I didn't see no tears. All dressed up to go away. First time I'd seen him smile in years. He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today.
So there's nothing wrong with direct lyrics if you can write it like that, right? No,
exactly. I think it was Loretta Lynn. I always have trouble saying that. Didn't she say that basically country music is truth? Yeah. I mean, it's just sort of like there's an authenticity to it. And, you know, she's basic. Her basic point is like when her career broke is when she started writing about her life.
Right.
Yep. When she started getting inside her own experiences, her own background. And I think the best country music really does that. It's such a strong personal statement, but it is delivered in a fairly simple, straightforward way. And, you know, I think that's some of the effect of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So one thing I want to get to, Nick, you mentioned before we started recording that you weren't as interested in the last couple of episodes because it got into the more modern country stuff. What I thought was really interesting there was the director, Ken Burns, made a choice. Yes, he does include, you know, segments on, you know, your Reba McEntire and your Garth Brooks and so on and so forth. But at the same time, he doesn't give them the same kind of screen time as some of the, you know, the other big country music stars predated.
Yeah.
He really goes off into a lot of like kind of alt country stuff, and he goes deeper into like people like Emmylou Harris and Gram Parsons, and even talks about there's even a part of there about the Byrds, Sweetheart of the Rodeo, and Townes Van Zandt, and you know, he kind of follows the artistic thread of country music, even into even into the more modern stuff, and you know, he does talk about, you know, again, like somebody like Shania Twain or somebody like that, but it doesn't go really deep because honestly, there's not a whole lot of depth there. I mean, what happened there was country music basically became pop music.
Yeah.
And yes, it had the like huge, huge success. I mean, they never had, you know, Nashville never had like albums that sold, you know, triple platinum and things like that before then. A big country record would go platinum.
Right.
So these people were superstars, but what they were doing, honestly, just, I don't think interested him that much, and I don't think it does really the viewers either. And then the whole thing ends in the 90s is where he ends it, and he ends it with Johnny Cash's career resurgence and the Rick Rubin stuff, mm-hmm. and then the death of June Carter and the death of Johnny Cash. And it's actually kind of a perfect sort of bookend because, you know, you kind of start to a large extent with the Carter family and you kind of end with, the Carter family,
right.
in a way. Yeah.
Right. So. Right. Makes sense.
That was a revelation to me though, because I've, June Carter and Johnny Cash, and, I love Folsom Prison album, and they sing together, and we've, some of us have seen the film, but it didn't dawn. I didn't realize that that was country royalty that Johnny Cash married into. Oh. I mean, that's there's something that's just so affecting about that,
yep.
How those two strands of music came together in, mm-hmm. in that marriage. And it was almost as if they were sort of destined to come together in that way. But, I didn't know a lot about the Carter family, A.P. Carter is a fascinating figure, a guy who actually, he went back to the old ballads, but he also was like investigating blues musicians, yep. The other thing that
he was also a great promoter.
Right.
You know how to promote those shows.
Exactly. Yeah. The other strand of this that comes through all the way through the documentary is, when you're talking about an American story, you got to deal with the issue of race and racism. And, it's really kind of an arbitrary marketing scheme that kind of made country music and blues music, blues music, and sort of separated those audiences.
Right.
And, record producers were like, yeah. This is race music. Mm-hmm. This is country music.
Right.
Well said, Nick.
But they came from the same place, really. And they had a lot of similarities.
And interesting, Nick, just to follow up on one point. Yes. Johnny Cash married into country music royalty. Who else married into country music royalty? Marty Stewart. He married a Cash descendant.
That's right.
Cindy Cash.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. Keeps it going. Wow.
That's right. And
they divorced. He later married someone else.
Wouldn't be country.
But of course
if
they divorced.
That's right.
Right.
And Rodney Crowell was in there. He married Roseanne
That's
Cash,
right.
right?
Yeah.
And didn't Nick Lowe marry
Carlene Carter?
Carlene Carter. Yeah. That's right.
So they're Carlene all in
Carter's
there somewhere.
In the documentary.
That's right. It's like Downton Abbey. Matthew and anyway.
Okay.
Crawley's.
Well, the other thing, if you're talking about the Carter family, you got to mention Mother Maybelle.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And it actually, I think, ends with her. I think the very last frame shows her picture, but huge, right? Not only just in terms
yes.
of being part of that original Carter family group, but apparently her guitar playing and what she developed on the guitar has been like hugely influential on just yeah. American music. Right?
I mean, once we interviewed Chuck Prophet, Jim, for our podcast, and he was like, Sex Pistols was basically, oh, we're just doing Chuck Berry. Cool. Wilco was just doing Mother Maybelle riffs.
Yeah.
Just like turn them up a little bit louder,
country
and that's what
scratch.
We're going to do. Yeah, that's exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has run kind of long. Any last thoughts here?
Well, I mean, it was a 16-hour documentary,
yeah,
so we had to do it some justice.
But there is some original content that you guys produced online that
yeah.
is a companion piece of this, right? So
right.
give that a plug.
Well, so if you go to weta.org/countrymusic, all one word, our department, digital media, and the local television department, we produced a bunch of video vignettes on the history of country music in Washington, D.C., which is a lot more of a rich history than most people would imagine. It was an epicenter for the early development of country music. It's, I think Jim referred to it earlier, a lot of folks moving up from the South to D.C., and wanting to sort of get back to the music that they were familiar with. So it becomes a center for Patsy Cline is from Winchester, Virginia. She gets her start at an Arlington radio station and is on, a TV show in Arlington, Virginia. Bluegrass has a really rich tradition in the D.C. area. The Birchmere, was born with bluegrass music. So we did a couple of pieces. You should check them out. And a lot of other, wherever you live in the United States, a lot of local stations did content, like the Nashville station, as you can imagine, did a ton of content around. And local stations often try to supplement a big Ken Burns national production with local connections. So I would say check out your local station as well, and yeah. you're probably likely to find
cool.
something.
That was some good stuff.
That's
there.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's get out of here. If anyone would like to comment, though, on
did you watch
the documentary,
it
did you watch
there,
it? Let
folks?
Us know what you thought.
Mm-hmm.
You can call 612-440-1984 or email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at Suburbs Pod. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is
Nick Scalera.
And we'll talk to you guys later.
He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door. And soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today.
I mean, Hank Williams had some nasty hangovers, and his wife was really mean to him. She was taking his money. So he was just trying to feel better.
That wasn't in the documentary. I don't remember that bit.
I just made that up. It should have interviewed me right here. I could have said that.